This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Floor 38.
I'm so excited to be having a conversation with someone when they have that revelation.
That maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're going to meet a strange and pretty remarkable character. He's a man who lost everything in a civil war. And stuck in a refugee camp in Africa, he's become a kind of outsider artist, and he's building a homemade museum. It's a very, very unusual story, and we'll explain more later. I'm also going to talk with Mikhail Baryshnikov about dancing and acting and aging, and also, because of course, Donald Trump. But let's start off with my friend and colleague Burkhard Bilger, who's been writing for The New Yorker since 2000. Burke, you've written about absolutely everything in your writing, and you've been digging into your family history lately. It's an unusual one. You grew up in Oklahoma, your parents were from Germany, and you've gotten more and more interested in their generation of Germans, people who lived through the Second World War as children and as babies. So how did you become interested in that generation, and why dig into it so deeply now?
Well, my parents are both what you call Kriegskinder, as you say. So they were born in 1935.
What does that mean, children
of? Kriegskinder means children of war. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're in an interesting spot psychologically. They were, you know, very young children during the war. And they carry, I think, the guilt of the war within them. And at the same time, they aren't responsible for anything. So this is kind of you're in between two.
There's no question of agency.
There's no question of agency. And so it was something they talked about, but they didn't really go into detail about. My grandfather was in the Nazi party, and my mother would acknowledge that, but we would never really go into any detail about it.
Burke, I have to tell you that even now, it's a startling thing. I remember when we were editing this piece and the pictures started appearing, there was a picture of your grandfather in the obvious uniform, and it was startling for me to put together this guy who I've worked with now for years and I have great affection for and enormous regard for as a writer. And then there's his grandfather in a Nazi uniform. Tell me a little bit about him and how you think about him and how I should think about him.
My grandfather was a school teacher in Aufing, a little village in Germany, and he was in his late 30s when the war started, and he was a fervent Nazi party member. And at a certain point, he was sent to a village in Alsace called Baltenheim as part of the German campaign to re-educate these young French students and turn them into good Germans now that they were part of the German Reich. But the fact that he was a Nazi didn't really come into our family conversations until I was late in my teen years. And my mother always talked about it as he had been sent there, but she never talked about what he did. And I think she herself, even though she'd written her dissertation on the German occupation in France, she never looked into that history. And so it was kind of this blank spot.
Because it was unbearable for her?
I don't know if it was unbearable. I think she was scared to find about what she would find out. She was scared to look into that hole. And then finally, late in the day after she'd handed in her dissertation, she went there and she discovered actually that there was more to the story, that he had been a fervent Nazi party member, but then he had eventually collaborated with the head of the resistance in the village. And there'd been a trial or an investigation for a trial, and eventually had been exonerated, and the villagers had kind of come forward to defend him. So it suddenly became a much more complicated story. And I went, I think, from having this guilty embarrassment in my family history to having something that intrigued me and confused me. Like, how could a person be both those things?
At what point did this taboo start breaking up in Germany and they started talking about the war in traumatic terms? When did Germans feel that this was even possible?
It's only been in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, people often talk about how it really began with the work of Sabine Bode, who did a lot of interviews with Kriegskinder and has written 3 books of oral history about them.
She's a historian or psychologist?
She is a journalist by trade and married to a psychiatrist, and she put these books together, and they kind of broke open the box. And I talked with her recently, and I asked her how she got onto this big subject and what drove her to it.
It started more than 20 years ago in the Balkan War. You know, TV showed the children suffering. And one day, as I'm a journalist, I asked myself, so what about the German war children? Must be, they're now getting pretty old or not. Or why I never heard about them? Why did I never hear how they coped with that fate? You know, what kind of silence is that? And at the beginning, I thought, well, that's an interesting story for me. I worked at the radio station at that time for the audience, and nobody was interested.
Was there a fear? I mean, I know that there's a resistance to talking about German trauma and German suffering during the war, because, of course, the Germans inflicted so much suffering on the rest of the world during the war. Is that why the radio station wasn't interested back then, do you think?
Yes. And at that time, all the editors in the radio stations or in the newspapers or the people in charge, they belonged to that age group, you know. So I had to wait for a change of generation that people said, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Why don't you make a piece for me? That's about my parents.
Right, right. So what was your first experience going out and trying to collect stories from Kriegskinder, asking them about their experience during the war and so forth?
Well, there was one thing, the way they spoke. It was either, oh, it was a funny time, we had a lot of good times, and it was a lot of adventure, and they told all those stories. Actually, some stories were really funny, I must say. Or it was completely without emotion, you know, like somebody is reading something in a telephone book. The numbness remained for many of them until they got old.
Right, right. I want to ask you a little bit about your own background. I mean, you had done some of your own research into your family history and war history as well, right? Was that one of the things that led you into this field?
No, I had it already done when I did it. And it helped me because I had my personal peace with my family story.
Do you mind talking about that a little bit? How did you start your family research, and what did you know when you started?
Well, I knew my father was a Nazi. I knew my mother was a Nazi. Everybody knew because they talked like Nazis almost until they died. There were these people who said, well, the way I talk about that time, everybody thinks like that, but they just don't dare to say that anymore. My father felt like a hero in a way that he was so courageous to say what he thought. And nobody stopped him as far as I remember as a teenager. It was very embarrassing for me, Yes.
What kind of things did he say when you say he the way he spoke? What kind of things would he say that were classic old Nazi thoughts?
Yeah, well, what they all said, it wasn't all bad. You know what Hitler did? He should have stopped earlier, something like that. He wasn't quite sure if the Holocaust happened or not, at least not to that extent, not with these millions he just couldn't believe.
And so then you thought you wanted to look into his own history as during the war or his father's history? Or what did you then research after that?
Well, since it wasn't much they told us, and after a while, but I was only able to do that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, because only then we had access to the archives we needed.
Do you mind talking about what you found, what the background history was that you discovered?
Well, he and my grandfather betrayed a Jewish relative. He was the husband of the wife. He was the husband of the sister of my grandfather. Hmm. He tried to hide as a Jew, and my father and my grandfather together helped the Gestapo to find him. He was murdered in Auschwitz.
Right. So what was it like to discover that? Could you describe the moment when you found that evidence in the archives, how that felt?
I tell you, it was a relief, because I thought, oh, that something like that, in way of that he was not a mass murderer. So what it did confirm me in what I always suspected and what I carried with me and said, well, listen, yeah, okay, that's the way it is. That was him. And all the relatives lied to me. That was really not nice. That was not nice to think of that over. That he kept silent and my mother's, well, that is easily to understood, but all the relatives did the same.
So you had always suspected that he had done a war crime, but you'd been afraid that it would be something even more terrible than what he did.
Yeah. Yeah, my generation, born after the war or in the end of the war or in the 50s, we all thought that was our main fear. Was my father a mass murderer?
When you say it's a relief, it's interesting. I know, when I was researching my own grandfather's history, which is ambivalent. I mean, there's evidence that he'd hid almost courageous things during the war, and then obviously he was a Nazi party member and was in occupied France, he must have also countenanced terrible things or allowed things to go by if not participated in. I don't know.
You know, we all come from these families. Why do you always put questions? You don't know anything. Keep quiet. Keep silent. Da 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 da. Yes. But your insight still has these questions. And then after a while you say, oh, I was right. That's a very good feeling. I was right, yes.
You and your brothers are very slightly apart. I mean, they were alive during the war, you were not. Could you talk a little bit about that? What was the difference between being a Kriegskind to being a Nachkriegskind, as you would be called?
I guess the main thing is when they were very small children, when they were just born in the first 1, 2, 3 years, they had parents and they had an environment of adults which felt stressed all the time, you know. Whereas me, I belong to the generations with the lowest rate of newborn. I must say, when I my early remembers is, you know, I walk out the house and I'm maybe 3 years old or 2.5, and every adult which meets me stops, says, hello, how are you, Sabina? Nice to meet you.
They were just so happy to have, see children.
Yes, I was carrying the hope, you know, for a better life.
You know, it's funny. That's very much my first memories. Strong memories are being 5 years old. We moved to Germany, to Karlsruhe, when I was 5 in 1969. And my mother would take me on her shopping rounds every day. And every store we went to, the shopkeepers were so kind, and they would give me a candy, a gummy bear, or they would give me a piece of German sausage, or they would, you know, there was, and it was that same. There did seem to be this hunger for youth and innocence and children in Germany, even
later. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Can you tell me a couple stories from people that really stuck out for you, that people told you about the kind of trauma they experienced, or stories that might have, things that happened to them that might have traumatized them during the war?
The strongest one I had, and it's about a woman, and she practically, the whole war, she was sitting in the air raid center. She was, that was a harbor city, and it was bombed from the beginning to the end of the war. I mean, it was incredible what she said, that one day she missed the shelter because she wasn't fast enough to, running to school. And then the alarm came and she wasn't fast enough and the doors of the bunker was closed. And then she was there alone, completely alone. You can't believe it. And in that bombing, and she said afterward, I never told anybody, because I was scared they would tell me, why didn't you hurry up? And at the same time, her mother was a person, she wanted her to be a happy child. And she said sometimes, why can't you be happy, you know? And this woman had a handicap, developed a handicap, and only very late, I think she was more than 70, she realized that came from her war childhood. She was so forgettable. She was so extremely forgettable. She forgot everything, good things, bad things.
It was her short-term memory that she, like her recent memories?
And long-term, both. And then she started to reconstruct her childhood. And it was quite a process. And what happened, the long-term memory got better and the short-term memory got better. And she was enjoying her age then because she said, you know, I love learning. And it was always hard for me to learn because I couldn't keep things in mind so well. And now I'm learning all the time.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, there's certainly people who will say, why should we care about German suffering in the war? You know, again, there was so much terrible things were done by Germans. Why should we care about the suffering of the Kriegskinder? What do you say to them? What do you feel about that?
I say, sorry, it is not only in Germany. I think we find the same stories in Poland and in Russia. We find them in Cambodia. We find them in South America. That is an universal issue. Of course, it varies from the history, from what happened, what kind of atrocities, how many victims, how many perpetrators. Okay, but parents cannot bear the thought that they were not able to protect their children. They're happy when children never mention that again. You know, then they think everything is fine. We have a strong resilience. Everybody of us has, I guess, or most of us have. But when you don't know that you are traumatized, then it is hard to overcome.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about Familienaufstellung, this type of group therapy. I mean, I was fascinated to discover how popular this type of group therapy is in Germany, and it seems to be I'll quickly describe it. It's a type of group therapy that people often use to explore their family history. And what you do is you spend a day or two in a room with 10 other strangers, and each of you takes turns talking to the therapist for a while and talking about what you're feeling, what your problems are, and a bit about your family history. And then the patient chooses strangers from the room to represent family members from their history. And those strangers then proceed to kind of almost channel the spirits of those people they've been asked to represent. They have dialogues, they suddenly have memories of things they did during the war, and often new information arises that they'll say, oh, I can sense that I was, I was molested by Russian soldiers during the war, they might say, or these new things come up. And it's become very popular in Germany, and it seems like a way in which people often explore the past when they can't discover the things they wanted to discover in the archives, or their parents didn't tell them what happened.
I don't know if it is a therapy, You know, it may be an initiation to start. Yes. My mother, for instance, had a brother, and he died in the war. The last day, she hardly ever talked about him, and it was her dearest brother. That kind of thing is that I sometimes call the ghost of the death. Yes. It is not something where you can, which you can solve, you know, with that. It can help you to start to get interested in your family story. I don't believe in healing by that. I believe in healing, I think, is a long process. I mean, war doesn't end when the weapons are silent, but war does, in fact, narrow relationships, you know. That is why so many people of your age group are visiting Familienausstellung. And some of them wish that this is, you know, you get out and you are free. That doesn't work.
Right.
But it starts. As, I don't know if it's the one you attended. It was the same. There's a lot of crying. There's a lot of mourning.
Yes.
And that is helpful.
Sabina Bode, talking with The New Yorker's Burke Bilger. Her books haven't been translated into English yet, but you can find out more about her at newyorkerradio.org. And coming up this hour, I'll get some music recommendations from the writer T.C. Boyle, who always seems to know what's cool, or a lot cooler than I know. And I'll talk with the great dancer and actor, Mikhail Baryshnikov. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. T.C. Boyle is one of our great fiction writers. He's also one of the most prolific. He's written 15-odd novels and countless short stories, and thank goodness a lot of them have been in the New Yorker. And he's got a new book coming out, and he dropped by the office recently, which doesn't happen all that often, so I wanted to catch up. Tom, it's great to see you. You're in from Santa Barbara. You've got a few things to recommend to us. What's up first?
Well, the first thing that's turning me on lately is a band, Fantastic Negrito. I would guess 2 months ago, I was listening to the student radio out of Santa Barbara, because they always play cool stuff, and I heard this arresting voice. It just riveted me. Now I'm in love again. No, this time is not with my hand. Wandering, murdering. Every time that I get the chance.
first, I'm a man. You painted pictures for me that I refuse to understand.
His father was a Somalian. He had a career of doing sort of blues in the 90s in L.A., and, you know, everything was rap at that time.
Right.
So,
so he's running counter to what was going on.
He was. The videos that I've seen on the internet are quite striking, too. He's a great performer.
Fantastic. What else is on your list? What else are you following these days?
My daughter, who's a filmmaker, turned me on to the little videos on the internet of Tony Zhou, Z-H-O-U. His show is called Every Frame a Painting. And he shows you how the filmmakers use their techniques. So with the Coen brothers, and I never knew this, they don't use the over-the-camera sort of thing of us having a dialogue here. You'd see me over your shoulder, and they'd see you over my shoulder. They put the camera in the center. I have no idea about this. But then he shows clips of all the faces from these wonderful Coen brothers movies, and you see how much more real and engaging it is. Just that simple technique. For instance,
so it's not the standard one shot, two shot that you'd see in kind of TV show or an average movie.
No, this avoids that. He calls it shot reverse shot.
And that means the camera is usually in between the two characters so that they each get separate shots.
Do I make myself clear?
In other words, they shoot a lot of singles.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
Ow! And he shows like this wonderful scene from No Country for Old Men in which Shigur, the really bad guy, the force of evil, is sort of debating with the woman at the trailer park.
Yeah.
And she is as tough as he is, but she doesn't realize, and this is where the humor comes for me, just how bad he is.
Think about how well you know this woman just from her clothes and her workspace.
We can't give out no information.
Yeah. Tony Zhou's films must be making the rounds because my son, who's a film nut too, has been watching them and constantly sending them to me, and they're
incredible. So you have seen them?
I have seen them. You know, now that you brought it up, he's been sending them to me, and they're funny and they're smart, and you learn a lot about the technical, artistic aspects of film that would normally run right past you unless you were watching carefully.
And they, in themselves, these 10-minute films, are great entertainment. You know, he's also done one I recommend to you of Jackie Chan.
His framing is so clear that in every shot, he's setting up the next bit of action. Here, even though we're watching the stuntman, 2/3 of the frame is the staircase. A few seconds later, we see why.
Jackie Chan is a perfectionist, and he will do the scene where he ducks around with a fan, 100 shots. So he might screw up 99 times, but he gets the shot. Whereas most actors are just faking it.
Now, Tom, I know you are a man of letters, and you're still reading. You haven't given up entirely on the book. What are you reading now?
Well, Bernd Heinrich, the nature writer. I'm particularly engaged with Winter World. I discovered it a couple of years ago. The thing I love about Bernd Heinrich, who is now 76 years old, is how engaged he is with nature in the fascinating way that we were when we were boys and girls. He not only goes out into the woods to discover things, he experiments. For instance, he found a dead chipmunk on the road, and he'd always wondered, what is the capacity of the pouch on the right side of the chipmunk's cheek? So he took this dead thing and filled it with 60 sunflower seeds. So that's how he knows. That's how we know.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
And I have a little quote for you, David, too.
Not all writers go to these lengths.
No, that's true. And he is endlessly curious. So here is a little thing from Winter World I'd like to give you. Digging under the leaves, I found dozens of stink bugs massed together, presumably settling in for hibernation. I disturbed them in their bivouac, and they were giving off their foul-smelling defense secretions. I did not need to taste them. I knew they tasted as bad as monarchs, but not nearly as bad, according to this gourmet, as a mass of overwintering spider eggs.
Good to see you, Tom.
Likewise, David.
T.C. Boyle talking about the band Fantastic Negrito, videos by Tony Joe, and the nature writer Bernd Heinrich. You can find out more about all of these things at newyorkerradio.org. Boyle has a new novel coming out in just a matter of days. It's called Terranauts. Now, by any conceivable measure, Mikhail Baryshnikov is one of the great performing artists of our time, and he's considered one of the greatest ballet dancers in history. He took on modern dance and became prominent in that, but as he got older, the transition ran even deeper. He started acting. And right now, this weekend and the rest of the month, he's playing one of his own artistic forebears, the great dancer Vaslav Nijinsky. Here's the backstory. Nijinsky was the star dancer of the Ballet Russe, the Russian ballet, a century ago, and also a very important choreographer as well, an international star. But Nijinsky began to unravel. He was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia and spent much of his life in an institution. Baryshnikov is performing as Nijinsky now in a one-man show called Letter to a Man. The letter of the title was addressed to Sergei Diaghilev, the founder of the Ballet Russe. Now Nijinsky and Diaghilev were lovers as well as collaborators.
Of course.
Yeah. And so this is a kind of unreceived letter from Nijinsky to Diaghilev.
Yes. And I'll try to find this in a second. For example, that it's to men. I cannot call you by name, because you cannot be called by your name. I need thought. I am not afraid of you. I know you hate me. I love you as a human being. I do not want to work with you. I want to tell you one thing. I work a lot. I am not dead. I am alive. Within me lives God. I live in God. God lives in me. I'm very busy working on dances. My dances are making progress. It's beautiful.
It's extraordinary. This Diary of Nijinsky's was first published in 1936 and then again in 1999. And not only is it haunted and moving, it's also an extremely important document for the study of mental illness.
It is really such a coherent memoir and diary. And Henry Miller said that, it was one of the most raw, fascinating book he almost ever read. He was compelled by its honesty and rigor. And it's really never happened. With all that Nietzsche and Van Gogh and Schumann, who really were schizophrenics at the end of their lives, nobody wrote anything about their feelings, about...
I mean, it's a coherent record of their own madness.
That's
in
right.
Some way.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, I watched this performance on video, and it will be at BAM quite soon, and I wondered to myself... You were a dancer for a long time, and you always planned to begin at least to step away from dancing in your 30s. You stayed longer than that. But did you plan on it, that becoming, in a sense, an actor? You had acting roles, obviously. People saw White Knights and other things. But this has now become the center of your creative life. Were you planning it?
No, it happened really one day. I was in Paris, and I'm still the good friend of Roman Polanski. Roman was performing in Franz Kafka's Metamorphoses, and he was stupendous in the role, so wonderful and so powerful. And I went twice or three times, you know, a couple of days on the row, and then...
This is
when? It was in
the
Paris.
70s.
Yeah, I mean, it was early 80s already, yeah. Kind of. Roman even said, you know what, I think you could do it. yourself. You should, of course, I cannot do it. I said, people spend lifetimes learning the acting craft, and I'm a dancer, you know. And he said, I know, you've seen you dance and this and that. You can do it. You can move in this particular production. He was already on the floor, you know, kind of like on cockroach, you know. And he really convinced that I would like to experience being on stage and hear my voice.
But did my question though is this, is did getting immersed in this craft at make getting a little older and not dancing at ABT or City Ballet easier to bear, to undergo?
I never planned, you know, any, I don't know what's next, I mean, for me in my life. You know, I did the first metamorphosis, let's say, when I was dancing full out. You know, when I arrived, I know I danced maybe Giselle, you know, in one evening, and the next day I rehearsed with Ellen Ailey and Judy Jamison, you know, classical roles, and then worked with Martha Graham. You know, I kind of went ahead of myself a little bit. And sometimes I succeed, sometimes I failed.
Now, if I'm right, all throughout your career as a dancer, you were asked to play Nijinsky in one form or another.
You know, believe it or not, like more than 50 years ago when I was 15 probably, it was my first acting experience in the Vaganova choreographic school. We had a sort of acting class. And one of my first scenes, it was a scene from Petrushka, which, of course, was very famous by Nijinsky's role. And at that time, of course, in the 60s, talk about Diaghilev and Nijinsky, you know, people who left Russia and never actually returned. They were people who, a lot of people thought that they abandoned motherland, and, you know, they were treated by Soviets like they were defectors.
Non-persons.
In fact, non-persons. Although they left a long time before the revolution, even.
You went back. You visited Latvia.
Well, Latvia is not Russia.
Have you not been to post-Soviet Russia?
No.
And won't go? Tell me why.
No, absolutely. I left for right reason, and I don't support that government, and I don't...
And even in the early 90s, there was no temptation?
No. No.
I was very surprised, Misha, to see a little video of you endorsing Hillary Clinton, not because I expected you to be endorsing Donald Trump, but in this ad, you seem to make it plain that the alternative reminds you of authoritarian systems of your own past.
42 years ago, I left a country that built walls to come to a place without them. But today, as a citizen of the United States, for the first time, I'm hearing rhetoric that reminds me of the Soviet Union of my youth, where it was... Well, it's obviously Mr. Trump's fascination with a strong people. And he's flirted particularly with Putin, you know. In my view, Russian people really admire people, fascinated by people whom they are afraid of. And that's what Mr. Trump wants the people, be afraid of him. And this is the very dangerous path, in my view. And I don't know personally. I have once my wife and him and his wife had a dinner that just happened. We were seated across the table. With the Trumps.
I want to know everything about that.
Well, it was a couple of hours of saying practically nothing. Nothing. He said, well, we're in the same profession. You build and I build. And that time...
built great structures, as he says.
That's right. Structures. No, because I've said, I've heard you build this something center, some. I said, yes, but I explained what we build, the Emberischnikov Art Center and all that. And I said, you building centers, and I build the Trump Towers, and I said, fine. And then he was wondering about sort of financial arrangements, how I raise money. And then he said, why you didn't ask me for money? I said, Mr. Trump, there's a long line probably to you. I said, no, you go around. You go around. You say no name. I've heard you play. I saw you play golf, in some of my courses. I have the most beautiful courses in the world, and you should play that. You should ask me. But President Clinton asked me for it, and he plays, you know. And I'll send a car for you. I said, no, I drive. I said, no. You know, then in back I said, well, thank God I didn't ask him for money. Just like would have been really.
Misha's hand gestures are beautifully Trumpian, and that's 50 years of training on the ballet stage and now theater. What's ahead for you after you finish performing Letter to a Man? What are you thinking about doing?
Well, I am doing actually a rehearsing dance show, and I never thought that I'd go back in my age back to dancing. It's minimal dancing, but it's an hour on stage.
You're 68. How do you keep yourself in dancing shape?
I work a couple of hours every day in the studio and try to...
The same old routines, the same old...
Yeah, I know, slightly different because I worked with a different kind of rubber balls and, you know, and then working with a physiotherapist, you know, and I know already my body so well that what I have to do. And then I do sort of version of a ballet bar, you know, from all those pliés and tendus and, you know...
What can't you do now? In other words, physically, what do you say? I'm not even going close to that. And is it frustrating, or do you understand it at the fullest sense?
Well, the body reminds me how old I am every time you wake up and go to the first trudge to the bathroom. It takes me an hour just to get...
So you wake up in the morning and you feel like someone's been beating you with a baseball bat as well?
Of course.
Oh, I feel so much better.
Of course. Of course.
Misha, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mikhail Baryshnikov, the one and only. He's starring in Letter to a Man, directed by Robert Wilson, in New York at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. The civil war in Yemen just got much more complicated and frightening in the last week. The Saudis launched an airstrike that killed over 100 people at a funeral, and the U.S. Navy launched cruise missiles at rebel-controlled sites after they fired on an American destroyer. The war in Yemen has been going on since last year, and already close to 200,000 people have fled the country. Many of them have ended up
in Djibouti, in eastern Africa, across a narrow strait from Yemen. Our reporter Nicholas Niarchos recently came back from reporting there in one of the refugee camps. As you would imagine, as in any refugee camp, it was hot and dusty, and people were just trying to find a way to make do, however they could.
They look delicious, these cakes. They're really...
But Nick met a man there whom the aid workers refer to as a kind of Peter Pan. In this tragedy, he's trying to make beauty out of whatever he can salvage.
So it's in the middle of the desert. You arrive at the camp. It's incredibly, incredibly hot. When you walk out of an air-conditioned room into this heat, you feel like you're going to be physically sick. But you don't really smell anything because it's so hot. All your senses are overwhelmed by the heat, and everybody's looking for shade. So you walk through the camp and people come up to you and say that they want to talk to you about different things. They want to complain about, you know, not having air conditioning or not having adequate food. And these are all really serious concerns. But at one point, this man approached me and he was smiling.
Lovely, isn't it?
And laughing. And I didn't really understand, you know, what there was to smile and laugh about. And he said...
My place in morning early is very, very nice. I wish if you come...
He said, you must come to my tent. You have to come and see my tent. Walk down this way. He pointed towards the Aden sector. And he said, you'll go to this place and you'll hear the birds singing. And then you'll have arrived at my tent.
You will be surprised when you see my free birds all around my fencing. They found the freedom. They found somebody who to feed them. I show you, come. Please, sorry. I have different kinds of food.
His name is Abdullahi Bashahil, and I hadn't been invited into somebody's house like that. People have come and said, you know, I want to speak to you about this, and I want to speak to you about that. But this was just somebody inviting me to see what he'd built in the camp.
Sorry, that's my gate.
Ah, I see. Thank you very much.
We went through a low gate.
Wow, it's really quite a collection around here.
And the fence was sort of posts joined by wire, and then there were sort of skulls hanging on the wire and pieces of wood and, you know, dolls' arms and various different sort of bits and bobs, basically, that he'd collected from the desert.
So, this is a civilian museum. Look, this.
So walking into the museum, there's one tent which covers a series of plants that Bashahil is growing.
Oh, wow, this is... So you've got a whole garden in here.
Yes.
What sort of
green pepper and bidingal. I don't know what you call in English. And that's all.
And there is a little sort of day bed in the middle of the museum. And you look around and it's completely different from everywhere else in the refugee camp. I've been thinking about this a lot since I came back, because it's this quality of sort of being inside a place that's walled off in this incredibly harsh climate, and suddenly you feel like you're in this little garden and this little oasis and this little paradise, and the rest of the world kind of melts away outside.
I will show you something. Look, I remember now. A saw.
Bashahil could sound crazy to people, but he's actually somebody who doesn't really come off as crazy when you meet him. He just kind of bowls you over with this great deal of energy. But he definitely is eccentric.
A saw.
Oh, wow. It's a very, very small sword.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Why do you keep it in water like that?
It is not water. Oh. It's, you know, gas and oil. Because... if it's gold, when you keep it for several weeks, It became shining.
Well, he's a funny guy, and he, you know, I was trying to ask him about his life before the camp, and he would always sort of crack these little jokes.
Can you tell me a bit about your life when you were in Adan as a child?
When I was as a child?
Yeah, for your life beforehand.
I was more handsome than you.
Believe me. I'm sure.
I was very, very, very handsome. And I was also very, very bad. I am very bad because God make me very soft.
Okay.
This is my problem. I am a soft person. This is my problem.
Bashir Hill worked as a road surveyor in Yemen, and he worked for a lot of Western companies. And he was actually a successful and pretty well-educated guy. He is a 63-year-old man. He doesn't have a wife. He doesn't have kids. He's from a sort of a well-known Yemeni family, but he's not independently wealthy particularly. He lived in Aden in the Mualla district, and he had built a good life for himself.
Tell me about your life in Adan.
In Adan.
Before the war.
Before the war. It was very, very, very good. Until they started the war. We became like animals.
He escaped in April of last year.
Discrimination.
He didn't have anything. He had the shirt on his back and he had a pair of trousers.
We became like slaves.
He arrived by himself, and he has made do in this camp ever since.
So thanks for God that I'm in Djibouti. I reach this place.
Bashir Hill has suffered a great deal. You know, he's lost his home, he's lost his country, he's been displaced, and he feels like he can never go back. And that's something that profoundly affects somebody.
So how come... And how come to live with people like that? The government in their hands.
Because of that, he tried to sort of root himself in this new place that he's found himself in. And he's tried to sort of leave a mark there. And I think this is kind of, he's planting trees and he's built this little museum. That's a bomb.
That's a bomb, exactly.
It's a sort of small, smallish, a mortar shell, really.
This is... You know, this.
It's a larger 50 caliber bullet.
Yeah, bullet, yeah. This.
It's an unused bullet.
Yes.
7.62 probably from a Kalashnikov. He used to be a road surveyor in Yemen, and he is very, very aware of distance, and he's got a very good sense of distance, and he walks for 20 kilometers every day by himself. He only walks by himself. And... Looks at the ground and picks up objects.
This is, you know, you can anyhow seat.
A pestle and mortar.
Yes. This is an old radio. It's no use to bring it, but I like everything is old and new. I found it in the garbage. I add to my museum. Look, and this.
He's not just a collector, he is an artist. He had this artist sensibility of wanting to leave his mark and wanting to kind of improve things by piecing material parts of his world together.
And this is an eagle face. Look, eagle face. I make it from stone, and when you go a few meters from far away from it, it looks like an eagle face.
You know, like from stone and wood.
It looks like wing. Huh? And this is the face of the eagle, you know.
If somebody were to act like this in New Mexico, they could be called a found objects artist. But this is somebody in a refugee camp in Djibouti.
There is another story. Why I escaped...
Everything that he had in this life was taken away from him by the war. But he's a hopeful guy.
There were two birds here.
Bashir Hill had two birds. He showed me the cage.
And I was looking to them.
And he said...
There is a third bird cage.
That one day he looked over at the cage and there was a third bird sitting there looking at the two other birds.
I looked, his eyes seem... He's very sad. He seemed crying.
He said that this was... you know, this affected him and he didn't want to keep these two birds caged. And he said, I free you for the sake of God. Opening the cage, letting the birds into the sky.
By chance, in the same day where I freed the birds, they told me the ambassador of USA will visit you.
So the ambassador was coming, and Bashir Hill thought, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? How am I going to welcome him into my museum and show that this is a sort of big occasion?
I said, how can I greet him? I have no birds. I have only chicken.
And found two other birds, and when the American ambassador arrived, he released the two birds into the sky as a sort of message of greeting.
I said to him, greeting you, you know, and let the birds to fly.
Bashir Hill releasing these two birds might seem to us like a very sweet gesture, and it was. But it was also a sacrifice, because these birds are a very valuable commodity within the camp. And he, in doing this, showed a great deal of respect for the ambassador. And when I called the ambassador, he was effusive in telling me how touched he had been by the warmth of Bashir Hill's greeting and how interested he had been to look around the museum. And while he had been there, Bashir Hill told him about a dream that he had, which was to be resettled in the United States or somewhere in Europe and to build a new museum. And he thought that by making his case to the ambassador, he would stand a better chance of being repatriated. The tragedy of the situation is that the ambassador is not in charge of refugee resettlement. It just seems to me a very, very long shot that he will be coming here.
After when I saw his reply, I don't want to talk too much. He smiled. I know his smile. He's keeping for me something. Maybe one day he will collect me. And I don't know, maybe soon. He's an ambassador.
It's Abdullahi Bashrahil, a refugee from Yemen, talking with The New Yorker's Nick Niarchos in Djibouti. That's our show for today, and thanks for joining us. And I got to close by wishing congratulations to Bob Dylan, who just won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Who'da thunk it? Mazel tov, Bob.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you...
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Everybody that was hanging out, now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud. About having to be scrounging your next